Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
The story of the Crescent Moon Bear on Forgiveness with Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes.
Thank you. I thought tonight I would tell you the Tsukami Guagamu story, which is the Crescent Moon Bear. And this story begins when a woman who's been alone for a long time, for many years, because her husband is away at war, receives a letter saying that he will be home soon, that the war is over, and she's overjoyed. She loved her husband, been faithful to her husband, and can hardly wait until he comes home. And she bakes and cooks all manner of delicacies to treat him and reward him with. And she dresses in her best kimonos, and she puts her hair up in the way that she remembered that he really loved it best. And soon down the road, she sees a man moving slowly. And as he comes closer, she realizes this is her beloved husband, and she runs out to the road to meet him. And she throws her arms around him, but his arms hang at his sides, and he does not embrace her in return. And she takes him by the arm, and she leads him up the path to their home and sits him out in front of the house and says, "Now you sit here, and I'm going to be right back. I'm going to come with some food, and oh, my love, it's so good to see you, and everything will be well, you'll see." And so she came out of the house with a tray full of the delicacies that she had fixed, and she laid them on the low table in front of her beloved husband, and with one movement of his arm, he threw them over, and everything rolled off the tray and into the dirt. And she said, "Oh, husband, have I displeased you? What's wrong?" And he stood up abruptly, and he walked off into the woods. And there he stayed all night and would not sleep in the house. And the next day, she did the same. She took the food to him and said, "Oh, my beloved husband, I'm so, so glad to see you again, because I've missed you so all these years." And she set the delicacies that she'd made with her own little hands before him, and again he, "Oh, I don't want this." And he stood up and he walked off into the woods, and she was beside herself, and she thought, "What am I going to do? This is terrible. He's been at war too long." So she decided that she would go to see the old woman healer who lived on the other side of the village, and this she did. And she explained to the old woman, "My husband, who was away at war for so long, and now he's come home, and I'm so happy, but he's not happy, and I try to feed him, and he won't receive food from me, and instead of coming into our home and sleeping with me, he wants to be in the woods by himself, and he's angry all the time." And the old woman healer said, "Oh, I've heard this story before. Oh, yes. Well, I have a potion that I could make. But you know, I'm missing one ingredient. I need a hair from the throat of the Crescent Moon Bear. Do you think that you're able to go find the bear and gain a hair for this potion that will, I promise you, cure this malaise that has settled on your warrior husband?" The young woman said, "I will, yes, I will. I don't know where I find the Crescent Moon, but I'll go look for the Crescent Moon Bear. I will, my love for my husband is great." And so with that, she set out with a little pack and a bowl and some rice, and she began to climb the mountains, and she climbed over the boulders that were in the foothills, and she was saying, "Arigato, osechai," because the boulders did not trip her. And she climbed up the next layer of mountains that were filled with thorn trees that had thorns like little stars on their ends. And this was the part of the mountain that belonged to the Moemboki, who are the spirits of the dead. And when she was able to find her way under all the trees with their thorns on their ends, she said, "Arigato zaisho," because it was that they allowed her to pass without harming her. And on she went up the mountain until she reached the top. And her kimono had been caught by boulders, and it was torn in many places, and her hands had been skinned and had some bleeding. And her hair had been pulled apart by some of the limbs of the trees that she had passed under. And so she was quite disheveled, but she was hopeful. And she laid her camp, and somewhere off in the dusk of the evening, she heard a great roar off in the distance. And she quietly picked up her bag, and she tiptoed until she came to a clearing, and there was the largest, biggest Usami Wugami she had ever seen in her life. And it was the crescent moon bear that had a great big crescent-shaped white fur on its throat. And she thought, how am I going to get a hair? And as the bear came back down on all fours and lumbered off to its lair, she followed it. And she saw where the bear lived. And she thought, all right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the bowl and put some rice in the bowl and this little bit of meat that I brought. And I'm going to set it here far away from his lair. And then when he comes out, well, who knows? And so there she left it, and she ran and hid a distance away behind a rock. And the next morning, the bear came out of the lair, and it looked about, and it chomped at the air and stood on its hind legs, and it roared. And it sniffed. It came back down on all fours, and it lumbered, sniffing along the way till it found the bowl with the rice with a little bit of meat in it, and it ate it all up. Well, she was very gratified, but it didn't bring her any closer to the bear. So the next day, she moved the plate a little bit closer. She moved it a little bit closer to the lair. And this time when she didn't hide quite so far away. And again, the next morning, the bear came out, sniffed around, smelled that delicate odor of meat and rice, found the bowl, and ate it all up. And day after day, she moved the bowl a little bit closer to the opening of the lair and hid a distance, but not so far away as the day before, until finally she was almost out of rice and the little bit of meat that she had brought. And so she decided that she would place the bowl of rice and the little bit of meat right at the opening of the lair, and that she would, in the bravest way she possibly could, stand right there so that when the bear came out, she might pluck a hair and run away very quickly. And so at that next morning, the bear came out indeed. And there, of course, was the food right in front of the bear. And the bear ate it up, looked at her, stood on its hind legs, and held its razor claws over her head. And she said, "Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, Wugamatsuhami, please. All I want is a little hair. Just let me take a hair. I'm going to take a hair right out of here. It won't hurt. Nothing will happen." And the bear just stood there as though it somehow understood. And she reached up, and she quickly plucked one of the white hairs, and the bear roared in the greatest voice that was so frightening that she fell to her knees, and she was so frightened she covered her head, but she didn't let go of the little hair. And the bear roared and roared and roared and roared, and the mountains shook, and the bear in its roar seemed to be saying things that she had been waiting to hear and things that she understood without understanding them. The bear came down on all fours, turned around, and went back into its lair. Whew, she was so happy. She had the magical ingredient. And so she ran down the mountain And she ran all the way down the top side of the mountain and around the circles of the smaller mountains. And she ran through the layers where the Motomboki lived. And she ran all the way down the breadloaf slopes down at the bottom. And she ran and she ran. She ran down the village road. And she ran into the house of the old healer. And she said, "I have it. I have it. I found it. Look, look, I got it." And of course, she was bloody and she was bruised. And her hair was hanging in her face and her kimono was in shreds. And the healer took the hair and said, "Oh, well, my daughter, surely this is a hair from the Crescent Moon Bear. Well done." And the healer threw it in the fire, where it was consumed by flame. And the wife said, "What have you done? What did you do?" I went up on the mountain. I went through the layers of the Motomboki. I went all the way to the top. I stood there with the Crescent Moon Bear, and I stayed to the side for days on end while it came out and it ate, and I moved the bowl closer and closer, and I too stood closer and closer. "What have you done? You've thrown away all my hard work." And the healer said, "No. This is the medicine that I'm about to give you. And go home. And what you did with Tsukami Wugami, what you did with the Crescent Moon Bear, and go home and do also with your husband." And she did. And they say that it took time, but after a time, all the war that was in the body of the man who had been at war for so many years was leached out, and it was replaced gradually and gradually by love. Love and hope that each day would bring good things, as everyone deserves. This is not a story about being nice to your husband. I mean, it could be, if you were so inclined, but it's not. It's a story about not being able to forego, not being able to forbear, not being able to forget, not being able to forgive. It's a story about being filled with such anger over what one has seen and what one has lived and what life has brought to one undeservedly. And the interesting part of the story to me is the part where the woman goes through all her travails, which, if we had a lot more time, the story is very long. I mean, each layer of the mountain that she goes to, she has different travails that she goes through, and something is always trying to trip her or catch her or snap her or break her. And the interesting part of the story is that she manages to go through all the difficulties out of love, out of wanting to heal. We've talked about fairy tales being representative of an entire psyche in which each character in the fairy tale can portray or represent one aspect of the psyche. And so in this way, we see in this fairy tale that the warrior, the angry man, the wounded man, portrays a part of the psyche that's dearly wounded but loved. Loved by a force of the psyche that endures regardless, that even though the aspect of psyche that's very, very angry continues to be angry and in fact resists any form of nourishment, any form of nurturing, that nevertheless there is some force in the psyche that perseveres, and more than perseveres, has hope. She has an idea that things can be better. And in resentment and in profound disappointment and bitterness, there is no hope. Hope is the missing ingredient. It's never going to change. It's never going to be different. The event is always going to have happened. Yes, that's true. This will never change. This person will never be any different than they have been. Well, they can say they're sorry all they want, but it doesn't move me. Or, in some cases, talking about self-forgiveness. Some part of me is always going to be wicked. Some part of me is always going to be reprehensible. Some part of me is always going to be unforgivable. And those stances eliminate hope. You remember the old Greek mythology of Pandora's box. Pandora had a box and she was told not to open it. And the way the story is told in a debased form is that she was curious and that she was unable to contain her curiosity. And so she opened the box and all the pestilences of the world flew out of the box. Death, sickness, etc. And so she's always accused of opening the box and bringing on all the harm of the world. In that sense, she's related to the story of Eve, so-called mother of humanity, who, by eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, brought all the pestilences into the world, that people were eternal before then, but afterward they all had to die. And people were born somehow magically, and after that they had to be brought forth in the pain of childbirth, and that people used to live in paradise, but now they had to be sent away and exiled from paradise and eke a living by the hardness of the land. That mythology is used to explain or to attempt to explain suffering in the world. But here's the part of the story that often is not told about Pandora. Pandora, yes, she had a box. She was a creatoress. And when she saw that human beings would live forever and that they would live without any consciousness of who they were, what they had done, where they had gone, and from what God they came, she felt perhaps the only way was to introduce mortality to them. And in all the mythologies across the world, you find this in the creation myths. Everything is paradisical at first. And then for whatever reason, in order for consciousness to develop, both in the God itself that created the humans as well as in the humans, difficulties are introduced. And through those difficulties, people and God are transformed. So she has the box of mortality. And she consciously makes a decision that this is the only way that human beings will ever develop past a sort of seething mass of unconsciousness. And so she opens the box and she takes out death, and she takes out sickness, and she takes out pestilence, and she takes out all of these things that cause mortality. And she's ready to close the box, and then she thinks, oh, these are the people I created. And I love them. And so there was one last thing in the box that she took out, and that was hope. And so in all the stories about Pandora, the idea is she's a wicked woman who brought bad things into the world. But in fact, her mythology is used in its proper sense to explain suffering in the world and the fact that hope mediates all suffering. Hope meaning an idea that I can do something, be something, think something, change something, be somewhere, go somewhere, say something, feel something, pray something, sing something, write something, paint something, act something that will make this just a bit different and better, or a lot different and a lot better, or that if I stay in this suffering, this wound that I've received, that something can come of it. It is my hope that even if I do nothing but think, feel about my circumstance, that I can learn something. And so we see in the Crescent Moon Bear story that her whole time is spent attempting to learn how to turn or transform rage into love again. And it's not a secret, as you know, but it has something to do with love and hope. And you might remember that when we're very, very angry, love is the last thing on our minds, eh? And hope as well, other than hoping people will die. In this story, she goes to the bear, and the bear is throughout every culture is representative of the Great Mother, has a brood every year and seems invulnerable in many ways, goes through a cycle of sleep and wakening that's very much like the Earth's cycle of winter and spring and return to light again. And so in that sense, anything that has those obvious cycles of sleep or death and then rebirth again is often thought of as a Great Mother figure. And so in this story, the inference is that inside a psyche also is the Great Mother. There's the wife who loves, has the endurance of love and hope, but there's something even larger than that. Something larger that would be a Godhead or a force of God that is forever and ever and ever and ever loving, forever and ever and ever giving. When a person is cut away from forgiveness, and believe me, as a psychoanalyst, I've heard, I think, the worst of stories of things that have occurred to innocent people, innocent children. And so I can understand that forgiveness may be a very difficult thing. However, in order to force oneself not to forgive, one has to cut themselves away from the great loving God of the psyche. And in so doing, suffers in many other ways as well that have nothing to do with the original incident of wounding and the subsequent rage and sadness that comes from it and feeling of weakness and the desire not to forgive. Begins to cut away from that huge force, cuts off hope in other directions as well, becomes the watershed experience for saying, well, see, this happened. And nobody else who's like that, and nobody else who looks like that, nobody else who smells like that, nobody else who even vaguely resembles that will ever treat me any differently. You see a reconciliation in the Crescent Moon Bear. The woman was willing to go on a quest to meet this huge force of love in the psyche, this inexhaustible force in the psyche. And instead of dwelling on the wound, is dwelling on the return, the reconciliation with love. Not love like I love you. This profound love that is utterly, utterly inexhaustible. And so then there she goes. And rightfully so, she's respectful and fearful. It's an enormous thing to see love, the biggest love you can imagine, in actual force. It's an amazing thing. I believe people like Father Romero, who was murdered in Central America, had that. I believe Cesar Chavez had that. I believe Archbishop Desmond Tutu has that. I believe that Sister Teresa has that. When I think of loving people of the world, they are people who seem filled with nothing but. They seem that they truly are living saints. We might be good and great and creative and all those ways, but a person who is filled with the great archetype of love or the God of love, all the way to the tip of their fingers, all the way to the tip of their toes, when we're in their presence, we're changed. And most often when people are in the presence of what we call a living saint, you know what they do? They cry. They cry because they're reconciled with the great force of love that flows through this person. Whatever this person is, they're just a shell, something Something stands behind them, something big, bigger than a crowd, something enormous. And they have become the instrument for all of that love. So in the crescent moon bearer, you see this. And this idea of the hair out of the crescent moon, there's so much symbolism in the story of the crescent moon, is another symbol of the stages of darkness and light, the dark moon, the new moon, and so on and so forth. And in Japan, the bear is very valued. It's considered a sacred bear. If anyone were to kill this bear, it would be considered that they would bring harm upon their family for generation upon generation. And this bear represents the force of love and reconciliation, no matter what, no matter what. And so she plucks finally the hair. In other words, she comes into intimate contact gradually over a period of time. She begins to overwhelm her own fear, and she's so taken more and more with her desire to return to a force of love within herself and for her mate that she does the bravest thing that she can do, and that's to come face to face with this force and to ask something of it. I have a friend who says to me, oh, she lives in Half Moon Bay. Oh, I was down at the tidal pools this morning and they threw me into prayer. And I suggest to you that prayer is not a recited little card by somebody who lived 1,500 or 500 years ago who had their own way of talking. I would suggest that prayer is a way of asking the God of love, of eternal, unremitting love, for something that will help you. And that God that lives, that we call archetype in analytical psychology, that some people call the Godhead, if they're from a more theological frame of reference, and some people call higher power, if they're in recovery movement or AA. And different people have different names for this, but you know, it doesn't matter what the name is, same thing. I like to call it God, in part because people for so long have been afraid to call it God. So I'd like to take that name back and use it again. Or, as I've always thought was really strong of people of the Jewish faith, to call it G-D, not even wanting to say it aloud unless there's special reason for saying such a powerful idea. So in this story, I have this idea that a hair, a single hair, which hairs often represent ideas, but this hair comes from the crescent moon. It comes from an instinctual animal. This has nothing to do with intelligence or the intellect. It has nothing to do with cognition. It has to do with deep feeling, deep emotion. There's an emperor of Japan in the 14th century who was the most unusual emperor they'd ever had, because he said that the valuation of land, the valuation of thinking, the valuation of spirit were all equal to the valuation of emotion. And that was a very unusual thing to say, that emotion is a jewel. That emotion, feeling, your feelings, even what we call the messy feelings, the ones that don't stay in the lines, you know, that even those are jewels of their own kind and are to be used for enlightenment. They're to be used in order to see in various ways. The colors and the shadows that they cast allow us to see in different perspective, our emotions do. And so if we were going to teach forgiveness to the world, can you imagine with the just words fail me of what's gone on in Rwanda, what has gone on in Serbia, Croatia. Can you imagine that to teach people not to take revenge on each other, that they have to change consciousness, that they have to be able to not be in the I, the little I with a dot over it, the little I, The Crescent Moon Bear story is about not being in the little eye. The moment she plucks the hair from the throat of the bear and the bear begins to roar and roar and roar, she's hearing things she never heard before. She's knowing things that she never could know before, things that are not tied to the mundane world, things that are not tied to something that you read in a book or that you hear at a place like this or that you listen to on the radio or that you watch in a film or on television. They are things that come from the God of love or Eros. They come from the God that is greater and larger than you and is your only hope for being healed from things that have hurt you. We resist going to that because we have to climb a mountain to get there. We have to face the spirits of the dead and ask their permission to pass. We have to be torn in some ways, bruised and bundled up and not warm and happy and well-fed, but we have to be in exile to an extent. We have to wander for a while. We have to be in a wilderness. And yet, it's the only way that since time out of mind, the mystics, the philosophers, the religious, the ministers, the priests, the priestesses of the world have talked about forgiveness. Is the only way through is through gigantic love. Not love with your little dot I heart, but gigantic love, the God that lives inside you and is larger than you are. So at the very end of the story of the Crescent Moon Bear, you see that the woman comes back down the mountain. In other words, you know, isn't that interesting? You go to get hope, so to speak, from the God that maybe you're not very familiar with, and it scares you half to death, and you do it anyway because you have a kind of love in you that will not take no for an answer. And you get there, and you go through the whole process, and then you have a rough time on the way back again. And that has to do symbolically with holding on to what you learned. Holding on, when you've been hurt badly and you want to forgive out of love, taking the path of love in order to release a whole room in this little house that you live in the psyche, in order to free up that whole room for something that you want to spend it on, not something that happened to you by default, but something that you want in your life, something you choose, not something that just dropped in on you one day or for a period of time. When you do that, and you say, I'm going to choose to forgo, to forgive, to forget, to do all these things. These are my goals. It's hard to hold on to because sometimes, say it's a person who has hurt you, you see them with your eyes and you feel aroused to rage all over again. Just the sight of them makes you angry. Or God knows they say something to you that probably starts with a phrase like, you always. Or do you remember the time that you fill in the blank? Or, well, if you weren't so, fill in the blank. Or, you know, you're pretty, fill in the blank. And the minute you hear those words or you see the person or there's something that reminds you, you feel angry again, except love is a stronger armor than anger can ever be. Love, love, love is a stronger armor than anger can ever be. There's a saying that nothing amazes people so much as a person with common sense who deals straight with people and who's filled with love. Nothing. Not high intellect. Not riches, not anything. As a person who'll deal straight with you justly and with love. I don't like what you did. It's over. I don't like it. If you ever do it again, I don't know what will happen, but it's over now. It's over. We're going to forget it. We're going to go on. Maybe we won't even talk to each other again, but when I see you, I will acknowledge that you exist in this world. I'll acknowledge it with as much love as I can, that there is something between humans that's decided long before we get here. Something that appears a pattern of some sort because sudden wounding happens more often than calculated wounding in this world. almost as though words rush out of people's mouths, hands reach out and strike, before people have even had a second to think. Certain things are so reprehensible, so ignominious, and so heinous, is absolutely true. There's also another level of truth that's been remarkable to me. I've known several people in my lifetime who swore up and down that they would never forgive, and it's usually been a parent. And it is true that their parents were, at the very least, had no conception of the human life that lived inside their own child. And in the middle ground were ignorant and liked it that way, and didn't want to understand. And at the most were malicious and premeditated in their harm that they did to their own children in one way or another. And what I've watched time after time is when the death of the parent approaches, if it's a death that gives warning, such as stroke or cancer or one of those where there's some time, that every single person I know has made an effort to have a conversation with either what is left of the person, you might say, if they've had a stroke and they're in a coma, or with the parent who is now clearly dying. And the peculiar thing is, though the now grown child is changed, the peculiar thing is that the parent who is facing death is changed. It's almost as though the person has said, the game's over now. Whatever it was we had to do here is done now. And the, you might say, archetypal conversation that goes on is, I did the best I could. And something in the child says, and it wasn't good enough. And the parent says, I didn't know any better. And the child says, you sure didn't. And the parent says, can you ever forgive me? And that is what opens the door. Can you ever forgive me? Yes, the answer is, if you can take the road of hope and love, yes. Change perspective, yes, you can. The answer would be no, however. If you feel weakened somehow and feel that that would somehow make you vulnerable, it means that you have work yet to do to strengthen yourself so you can move into that. Some people move into it after the person has died. When the person was dying, they hadn't done all the work yet that they felt they needed and wanted to do, and so they waited, which is also all right. They waited until after the fact, and made their reconciliation at the gravesite or at the places where the ashes were strewn and so forth. Those stories that I know firsthand of people forgiving after years of saying, I won't forgive, and sheathing their hearts in ice, those have been the most poignant to me, because I think that they're proof that there's something inside the psyche that no matter what has happened, wants to love and wants to understand from a different perspective than the little eye with the dot over it, wants to understand in some way that will allow it to feel the fullness of the love that it brought into this world, and all for a purpose. So at the very end, of course, the old healer takes the hair that she's won so hard and that she's had to hold on to all the way down the mountain, no matter what she's been assailed with, and throws it into the fire as though it's a nothing. And the fire blazes up for a moment, and the woman says, what on earth have you done? My only hope. And what she doesn't understand quite at that moment is that the teaching is an inside, not an outside teaching. It's a teaching about changing, forgiving, drawing closer to the God of love, going through mountain ranges to find love. And it's an internal process. It has almost nothing to do with the person outside. The only thing you might say ultimately that the person outside yourself gave you by giving you blows of various sorts is they gave you the opportunity to find this huge force of love and to stay close to it for life. And it's hard to stay close. It's hard. You see that in the tale. It's hard. It has to be practiced over and over again, returned to. That mountain has to be climbed sometimes more than once in order to gain all of that. So this old healer in the psyche represents something in the psyche that's ever wise. It is the, you might say, the integer between the world of spirit, that place where change of perspective can occur, and the world of the little I, the world of the mundane I, your actual life, my life, our life with other human beings here in the world, getting along with one another, finding places where we bridge, trying to not so much pay attention to places where we don't, unless they're critically life or death matters to us. And so in the very end of this tale, the woman goes home again, filled with hope. It's often in fairy tales and mythology that something's consumed by fire. The fire transforms. In Hindu mythology, Agni is the god of fire. And Agni is the fire, the flame, and Agni is the wood that is burned, and Agni is the heat that is given off by the wood that is burned, and Agni is the ashes underneath the wood that retains the heat overnight, and Agni, if you carry it to its extreme, Agni is the woodcutter who goes to cut the wood, and Agni is everything. And so throwing the hair, that idea that hope can come and love can come, into the fire transforms it into something entirely different, a meaning, an idea entirely different than it was before. And that old healer in the psyche is a representative of that ability to say, this is how it looks on the outside, the situation with this person or these persons or this group or this friend or this boss or this lover or this mate or whatever, but here's how it is on the inside. Bring it on the inside and then see. Now, with my clients, sometimes I feel that it's very useful because there are sometimes so many hurts, so many slashes, so many slings and arrows in a lifetime. And I find this, interestingly enough, often happens to people who I call sensitives, who are sensitive to everything. People look at them wrong. They're bruised. And they often have little ability to protect themselves. And so on top of being vulnerable and sensitive, they have very little ability to defend themselves. And it's very important that they learn to do that. But they are often the ones who have time after time after time after time of things happening to them that are very painful, very wounding. So there's a concept of desconsolos. It is a term that's used in the Roman Catholic religion in Mexico. And descanso means resting place, place to rest. And when you go in Italy or in Mexico or in any of the Latin countries, and even in the Southwest, you see little cruces, little crosses by the side of the road. They're usually white, and they usually have plastic flowers hung around them that are all faded out from the light of the sun. And sometimes they're wooden crosses, and sometimes they're made out of styrofoam and various and sundry things. And that means that that's a place where there was an accident or where someone died. And so putting the cruz at the place means be at rest now. Be at rest. It's over now. Here you are, and I decorate you. It's very similar to decorating the soldiers with the medals. I decorate you. I note that you here were hurt, here you died. Here, I notice your heroism, your endurance, your innocence. And so I ask people to take a long sheet of paper and to draw a timeline of their life, starting from the time they were born all the way to the age that they are now. And then I ask them to put the descansos on the paper, to draw the crosses on the paper that signify the place in life where they had to stop, where they had to rest, where they were cut down, where they were mown down, They're pushed down, shoved down, not allowed to get up. They were tortured, exiled, shunned, broken, humiliated. And to say for each single one, for as long as it takes, to say for each one, who was that person at that time? It's a six-year-old child. Let us decorate that child for her bravery, for his bravery in that moment. And let us put a cross there as the resting place for that child who was 6 years old. And so on, all the way along the line. Then here's another cross. Something else, the death of his mother, who loved him, was the only person, maybe, who he ever felt love from. And her death felt like a breaking, felt like a wounding. Let this 34-year-old man rest now. It decorate him for his heroism. And let him rest. Notice that these things have occurred to him. And that he's made different now. And he has history now. He has scars. You might say he belongs to the Scar Clan. And that the woman who goes until she's 50 and suddenly is left alone, either by death or desertion, and let her put a cross there where it is. And also, as sometimes when people become older, sometimes in their 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, they want to begin putting crosses for things they thought they would be or hoped they would have when they were 20 or so years old. And it's not going to be this time. They're probably not going to be a prima ballerina now. And they want to put a cross there. And sometimes I say, yes, but sometimes they say, no, you're only 80. You could still be a prima ballerina. And so in this way, we put a end to things, change perspective on them, and bring them into love, the love of that great one that stands behind us, who blesses all things, forgives all things, forgives us, creates all new life. The daughter of Chilam Bilam. I dreamt one night when I slept in Guatemala that the Chilam Bilam, the great jaguar priest, remembered the time his daughter saved the Mayan race. The great floods were coming and there was war upon the land, and the necks of the slaves burnt from the rope, and the old women hobbled fast with tables upon their backs, and fires boiled over, and animals ran every which way, and flame burnt the divine jungle. And the daughter of Chilam Bilam inhaled all of the animals, and all of the trees, and all of the birds and flowers, and all of the beautiful old men and old women, and all the new babes, and all the nursing mothers, and all the plowing men. She inhaled all the sweethearts and all the creatures of the jungle and of the sea nearby, and the pine forests of the highlands and the deserts and the lowlands. And she inhaled everything that was beautiful or young or old. But now she had a dilemma. She could not let her breath out without spilling. She opened her mouth, and the leg of a little old man would come out. She put it back in. Or she paused to take a breath, and the long hair of an old woman would slip out the corner of her mouth. And she'd have to press it back in where it belonged. Now, what would she do? So she could not let her breath out without spilling the forests and the jungles and the animals and the people she had inside of her. And so one night, she began with the dreamers of the nearest village, and she crept into the place where they were sleeping, and into their open mouths and open ears, she breathed some animals and some flowers into their dreams for safekeeping. And through their mouths while they slept, and through their ears, she breathed into them all the montañas and all the molineras, all the rivers and all the serpents, and all the old women and all the newborn and all the orchids and all the parrots in the trees and all the things that make life what it is and good. And when she was done there, she ventured even farther and farther across the world, filling the nights and minds of dreamers with her enormous breath. And that is why today people dream monkey and mountain and jaguar, and people dream orchid and quetzal. People dream old dark women and old men, even though they have never seen these ones in real life. They dream because they receive the bounty of that divine woman long ago, that woman who saved the world. And it is said that this daughter's name, Adebelan Chilam, translated from the Mayan K'iche into Spanish, is called her name Esperanza. It is said her name translated into English means hope. Oh, thank you.
Say there ain't no bears in Arkansas. Some folks never seen a bear at all. Some folks say the bears go around eating babies raw. And some folks got a bear across the hall. Some folks say the bears go around smelling bad. Others say that a bear is a honey sweet. Some folks say this bear's the best I ever had. And some folks got a bear beneath their feet. Some folks drive the bears out of the wilderness. And some to see a bear will pay a fee. And me, I just bear up to my bewildered best. And some folks even see the bear in me. Out of the wilderness, some to see a bear would pay a fee. For me, I just bear up to my bewildered best. And some folks even seen a bear in me. They saw me meet a bear and take him on out to lunch with you. Even though your friends may stop and stare, just remember that's a bear there. Bunch with you, and they just don't come no better than a bear. I saw me a bear and take him on out to lunch with you. Even though your friends may stop and stare, I just remember that's a bear there and the bunch with you, and they just don't come no better than a bear. No, they just don't come no better than a bear.
Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman. A weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far out ideas, magical foray and spellbinding song. Stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.